720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday with me. Most grateful to you for that. Lots to do today here on the show. Plenty of things to talk about. We are going to be talking all about lots of cool stuff, including how to perhaps charter a plane. We're going to be talking about that, and we're going to be talking about that Yahoo hack. But first, we're joined right now by phone by Yuri Ratner, who is founder of Nelson Cash, a Chicago creative agency that had two wildly successful viral campaigns over the summer. That here to talk about those. Joining us now is Yuri Ratner. Hi, thanks for joining us.
Hi, nice to be here.
So tell us about the agency and these two viral campaigns, because I think anybody connected to social media has probably seen them, these memes and these campaigns, and they're super wonderfully weird and cool. Tell us about them and how they came to be.
Yeah, we're a creative agency, and we do a lot of experimentation. And both of these came out of conversations that we've had in the office with our designers and developers. Talking about brands we love, things that are topical, and wanting to really celebrate, those brands and create something for the fans and for ourselves and for everyone to enjoy.
And so this one in particular was connected to LaCroix sparkling water, the water that people obsess over in a very big way and stockpile like it's about to fall off the earth. How did this particular campaign come together, and what really was the idea that it started with?
Yeah, we're big drinkers of LaCroix. I actually get in trouble if I don't stock the fridge with it. The team gets a little angry. So we were literally sitting around one day talking about LaCroix. We realized how much we love it, how great the brand is, how interesting the branding is. The first idea was, how do we make a fan page for LaCroix, because on the online experiences out there, we thought we could create something that'd be fun for people like us who love the brand. And over a series of conversations, it turned from just a fan page to, what if we created an experience? What would that be? What would that look like? I've got really creative people, and they're constantly coming up with interesting, fascinating ideas. And we realized, like, one of the great things you'd want to do with any brand is really partake in it yourself. How can you personalize it? How can you change it, for your taste? And then we came up with this idea of, generating your own can and your own flavor and being able to share that, with your family and friends.
Which I've seen those all over Facebook. I mean, people are posting, like, here's the, bacon jalapeno LaCroix and all of the kind of interesting flavors of them. What have been some of the highlights of them that you have seen?
Oh, there's a lot out there. Actually, we're about to do a blog post on some of that. And we did another experiment like that for Stranger Things, a television show. And we actually put out a blog post of all the words that people put into that generator as well. I don't want to disclose too much because we're about to publish something, but I think we're going to share it with the world real soon. Let's just say there's a ton of creativity out there in the world, and people, there are really funny, funny things that people are doing, and we're really happy that they're enjoying it and sharing it and all that good stuff.
Right. Well, anytime you leave things in the hands of Internet Nation, strange things can happen, i.e. boats get named Bodie McBoatface, but also, generators come up with interesting things, and people are, I think when they're allowed to exercise their creativity, interesting things happen. But, there was a piece in Chicago Magazine about your agency, and it notes in there that you leave a lot of time on Fridays to experiment and come up with new things. Was that creating that space in people's day? Was that difficult to get people on board with? Was that something people really embraced from the jump?
Yes and no. Definitely people embrace it. And it didn't always start out with Friday. We sort of were doing the 20% thing that we had heard about. I think Google was one of the pioneers of that. My job is creating the ecosystem so that creative people can do their best work. And, one of the things I've realized over time is that they need very dedicated time and space where they can really, get in the zone. Switching their day up with meetings or phone calls or too much distraction sort of breaks their concentration and just reduces the productivity. So the 20% thing, again, it's hard to know. You know, I think people weren't using it. It wasn't the right space to really do enough work to create something. So we had this idea of, well, let's just dedicate Fridays. We'll call it Freestyle Fridays. And that's worked very well often. I still think there's things we can do. You know, some projects take longer than a day. How do we make space for that? Maybe I think in the future we'll be experimenting with maybe not just Fridays or Fridays for some people or some projects, but also maybe just whole weeks or whole months for others. And actually the generator, both generators were a small team and they had more than a few days to work on that. In the case of LaCroix, I think it was about 2 weeks. And Stranger Things, same thing, about 2 weeks. You know, giving creatives the freedom and focus on that has really been key.
Well, and I think what's key about what you've just said is having that, you said, dedicated time and space. Because I think we can say, this is a creative environment, go be creative, do your thing, devote 20, you know, carve out 20% of your time to just brainstorm and you do you. But I still think there's sort of a thing laying over us in an office culture where we need to look busy and look productive and sometimes, you know, just giving yourself time for contemplation and brainstorming doesn't look necessarily very productive. And so I think, you know, you've really hit on something with having a devoted time to do it, because then it's permission, it's space that you have set forth for people.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, there's a balance. There's something there that both nature and nurture.
Sure.
How do you create the right environment to nurture what may be inherent in someone? And like we're saying, creating that right space. Interestingly, it's probably different for different people and different for different people based on their roles, whether they're a designer or developer.
Sure.
or animator. So it's really, how do you create a system that is both flexible for different people and different situations, yet equal and fair across those? It's an interesting challenge. Don't know if I've totally solved it, but I think we're on the right path to really solving that.
Yeah, something that's kind of equally nourishing to all different styles of work and all different job titles, for sure. Yeah,
and balancing it with our client work. Obviously, you know, everyone wants to get paid. We want to run a business. We want to be successful. So
definitely, go ahead. Sorry.
Go ahead. I was going to say that you know, that gets into conversation about investment in people and in things like, you know, the generator, the LaCroix generator that we made, which we don't get paid for up front, but may, we'll see, you know, pay off in the long run. And that to me is an investment and worth making. So as an owner in the business, you know, I often think it's not just, there's a longer term goal you're often reaching for, and giving people the space to experiment often pays off in my experience.
Absolutely. And we look forward to what you come up with next, having given your employees all of that time and space to be creative. Yuri Ratner, founder of Nelson Cash, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, do you know what Fly Auto is? If you don't, you will. I've got one of the founders in here in just a few here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday. You know, it's a little overcast out there, but I'm seeing some short sleeves. I'm not seeing people quite as bundled up looking as they were earlier. So get out there and enjoy that warm weather while you can. And of course, we will keep you updated on all the weather as per usual. All right, my friends, still lots to do on the show today. And, you know, when I first read about this next company we're talking about, I thought it was such an interesting idea, but I could not figure out for the life of me how exactly I might use it. But turns out there might be lots of uses for lots of people. Joining us in studio is Rod Rakek. He is the founder of Open Airplane, and he's joining us now to talk about Fly Auto. Welcome to the program, Rod.
Thanks for having me. Amy.
For sure. So tell us about Open Airplane and what you do and Fly Auto, which you're just now introducing.
Open Airplane is a startup here in Chicago. We make renting an airplane as easy as renting a car. And we started that in 2013, renting aircraft to pilots. But we wanted to give everybody else that magic power, that kind of flexibility and travel. So we created Fly Auto. And Fly Auto matches travelers with pilots and planes on demand.
So you can live out your James Bond stuff is what you're saying to me.
Well, it's a really great experience to be able to push a button and have a pilot in a plane waiting for you at the airport to take you where you want to go.
And is that, I mean, what is the most practical application of that? Who needs, because it seems like we've all gotten in a place where it's pretty easy to book commercial travel and we've all got our Orbitz apps and all of those things. And so who is going to use Flyauto who should be using Flyauto, who's maybe used to just kind of like going to the Delta app or the American app?
Amy, the airlines will take you to about 300 airports across the United States. The secret I want to let everyone else in on is that there are over 5,000 public use airports available to you when you fly private. So the airlines are built on a hub and spoke system, which works great if you want to travel from a hub city to a hub city. But it's a pretty terrible experience if you want to go from a spoke to a spoke. That's where private aviation really shines and solves a big problem.
Interesting. So, right, because that will eliminate the connection through Houston and then through Boston or whatever just to get to, something that sometimes isn't that far apart, but you have to fly through the hub.
Right, and even shorter trips. So the service we're creating, because we're not using jets, we're using lighter aircraft that are a lot less expensive, so they're much more of a value. We can do a business trip that's less than 500 miles and beat the airlines door to door. A much better experience, but now you get to travel on your own schedule. So for a business owner, you know, that's a magic power. That's a competitive advantage.
And is that doable affordably? Is that I think we think of chartering a plane as something that only the Trumps of the world get to do.
Well, that's why we built Flyauto as a new kind of travel brand. So we can put three passengers on a plane on demand here in Chicago and take them to a place like Traverse City, which is a terrible, eight-hour drive. And we can be there in 2 hours comfortably in an airplane that has the cabin dimensions of a BMW 3 Series. And we can do that for $1,500.
For three people?
For the whole plane.
All right. Okay, so not millions that perhaps we think it might be, right? And so how much time in advance? So if I'm the user and I get my Flyauto app or I go to the website, how far in advance do I need to schedule that?
Well, we tried to make this as easy as possible, so there's nothing to download. You go to flyauto.com, FLYOTTO.com on any device, smartphone, tablet, desktop, computer, and we just ask you two questions. Where would you like to be picked up? Where would you like to go? And we'll give you prices and flight times and different choices of aircraft and in real time. We can do bookings same day. Typically, it's going to be something you're going to plan a couple of few days in advance, but we make it really easy.
I feel like if you are scheduling a private plane on the same day you need to travel, you have probably made some good life decisions. You're living right if you're like, you know what? We're going to Atlantic City. Let's go.
You know, these businesses already exist in small towns and cities all across the country, right? They're mom and pop operations, but it was really hard to sort of access these kinds of pilots and these kinds of planes before. And this was really a way for us to be able to sort of unlock that demand and make it way easier for, you know, regular people to be able to fly like this and, you know, have the flexibility and have a great experience.
So we had a caller just a minute ago that asked our esteemed producer, Griffin Filipich, if dollar amount that you said, $1,500 for three people to Traverse City. Is that round trip? Is that one way?
So that's going to be just the one way trip. But what we can do is for up to two nights, we can actually price the trip in real time so that the pilot sticks around while you go play a round of golf or you go to that important business meeting or you go to that dinner with family. And then they can come back or they can even, you know, we can put them up, in the hotel. And we handle all that logistics that typically happens, you know, in this kind of charter world when you're thinking about jets, you're thinking about these big ticket kind of travel options that most people can't afford. We're making all those logistics sort of disappear. And you could tell us when you want to be picked up, when you want to come back home, and we'll go ahead and recalculate the price in real time for you.
I feel like if you charter, you mentioned like a golf trip, right? I feel like if you charter a plane for golf or something like that and you don't close that deal with whoever you're trying to close that deal with, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you then. I feel like, because, you know, there's some probably cachet of like taking your client somewhere in a plane. But you know, we think of this as something that's so out of reach financially. What other misconceptions do people have? As you've been talking about, I know you did a big road trip and talked to a lot of people about Fly Auto. What questions came up for people that maybe not necessarily resistance, but what questions do people have that pointed to perhaps misconceptions about private air travel?
Well, one is they don't understand that there's all these, you know, local and municipal and regional airports that really make the United States so much easier to travel than most people know. It's like a secret power that really titans of industry, celebrities and maybe crazy people that, you know, go get pilot certificates, you know about. And it's a secret to everybody else. And we want to let everyone else know, you know, that it really can be easier, that there is another option than just spending 4 to 6 hours stuck in the car on the highway, or really spending most of the day stuck in airline terminals because you're trying to get somewhere in a regional airline. So they're shocked to find out how many airports there are.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then the next thing I ask is, how much is it going to cost? But for $1,000, we can fly 3 people to Springfield. Right. Instead of driving down there for a meeting. Right. Ames, Iowa, Ann Arbor, you know, Michigan for a football game is about $1,500.
Yeah. What about safety? I mean, I think that's such a big part of our consciousness right now with air travel and, you know, the long TSA lines and those kind of things. But we're happy to have TSA there. What how does safety work when you're in it and all that kind of screening stuff? How does that go when you're in a private plane?
Right. So by bypassing the big commercial airline experience, you're bypassing the TSA. There's no pat down. There's no radiation involved to get on a small plane with a professional pilot who's been certified by the FAA to hold out this kind of air carrier services. These are all businesses that are really tiny little airlines. They just don't know where they're going tomorrow.
Right, right. Well, and you are a pilot yourself. Anybody who follows you on social media sees lots of cool pictures of you above the beautiful city and in your like pilot stuff with your, you know, headset doing all the pilot things. So this is cool to see that how you've put your passion for flying to use to give that experience to more people. So everybody head to
flyauto.com on any device, FLYOTTO.
Excellent. And you can find out all that you need to know all about that. Rod Rakic, thanks so much for being with us today. All right, my friends, we are going to take a little break and get you to news and all that good stuff back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks so much for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday with me. Most grateful to you for that. Hope you are appreciating and enjoying some of the warm weather while we got it. It's warmish. It's starting to feel fallish, though, that's for sure, my friends. But remember, our February selves will thank us for being outside now. So go soak it up, will ya? All right. Still lots to do here on the Business Lunch. We are joined now by Vipal Monga, who is a reporter at Wall Street Journal, to talk with us a little bit about this very interesting story about Yahoo that's been emerging. Welcome to the program, Vipal.
Good afternoon.
Hello. So this, I don't know if you've all been following this story, but it is certainly an interesting one that investors just started to worry as we closed out last week that this very large security breach that was disclosed by Yahoo, that it might impact the company's very large deal to sell its core business to Verizon Communications. That deal is worth almost $5 billion. So we're not talking about chump change here, my friends. But even though the breach was a couple of years ago, this is sort of all this has been, that was disclosed a couple of years ago anyway. It's been emerging. All these details have been emerging. But suddenly, it really kind of came to a head this week. So talk us through this a little bit about just kind of the timeline on all of this, if you would.
So it's a little murky in terms of the timeline. What we do know is around 2014, some state-sponsored hackers breached Yahoo's user accounts and got information, password information, security key information, and basically stole it. What we have found out is that in 2014, Yahoo had some sense that Russian hackers were looking at 30 or 40 accounts. It's unclear whether that hack was the same one that they were reporting, just found out about in August this year. That second hack, might have been the same hack, was for 500 million user accounts, which is about half of all the users that Yahoo has, which is a big deal. They apparently found out about it in August, which was after they signed the deal with Verizon. And then Verizon found out about it this week, which Verizon isn't too happy about to find out about this at this later date. So that's where we have it. The investigation is still ongoing. It's unclear what what else we're going to find out.
Right. And so do you have a sense of why it took Yahoo so long to disclose all of this to Verizon? That seems like such a long time for them to not be completely looped in on it, given their potential partnership there.
Right. Well, between August and September, I guess, is the timeline we're looking at. We're assuming that they didn't know about this 500 million person hack, in 2014. So it's not a 2-year time frame, it's about a month or so. But Verizon is still, according to our sources, pretty unhappy that it took this long for them to find out. It's unclear why Yahoo didn't tell them right away. We don't know who up the chain at Yahoo knew. So that's all yet to be determined. And Verizon, it's important to note, hasn't closed the deal for Yahoo yet, so they don't have the right to conduct their own investigation.
Right. And so talk to us a bit about that deal. I think we've heard anecdotally about this big Yahoo Verizon deal for a while, but the details of it, and especially what it would really look like, what it could potentially mean, I'm sure you have a stronger sense than anybody of what all that could entail.
Right. So we're talking about a $5 billion deal where Verizon is buying the core business of Yahoo. So the core business being the internet portal, the ad business that they have, and basically the users that they've collected over time. It's important for Verizon because Verizon wants to build an ad sales model. They want to generate online content, sort of moving away from just their telecommunications business. And they need to make money by selling ads, which is part of the reason they bought AOL a little while back. Now, you said the $5 billion isn't chump change. It is actually kind of is chump change for Verizon. They made $40 billion in cash flow just last year. So $5 billion isn't really that huge a deal for them.
So it's relative chump change, right?
Relative chump change, exactly. The thing about Verizon is the question that they'll be asking for them is, does this breach constitute what in legal, M&A sort of or mergers jargon is called a material adverse change, which means has a breach significantly impacted Yahoo's business and changed sort of the economics of it. Now, the material adverse change clause has been sort of boilerplate in M&A contracts for years, but it has never been successfully used by any company to try to break a deal. In fact, the only time it's really been tried or litigated a couple of times in Delaware courts, the court sided with the sellers, saying that the company that wanted to use a material adverse change was sort of in the wrong. So it's a very high bar to clear if Verizon decided to go down that path.
Certainly. And it was interesting to watch the Wall Street reaction to that, really, because it's, in so many ways, for as much as tech is such an established part of our economy now, there's still some degree of mystery around how we value certain moves within the tech sector, particularly when it has to do with a breach. I mean, we're really talking about the value we place on not just data, but security, privacy, and the act of a committed breach, right? It speaks to things that I think sometimes we don't totally know how to value, and therefore we blow it out of proportion, even if when voting.
Right. I mean,
dollars.
You actually call those assets intangible assets. So they don't have any substance. So basically the idea of valuing them becomes a guessing game or an art form. And that, again, would make it very difficult for Verizon to argue that this is a significant breach because what exactly are you valuing? It's a very squishy thing. That's the world we live in these days. The economy isn't really producing nuts and bolts or things you can hold in your hand, but ideas, content, all these terms that, it's literally impossible to put your hand around.
It is. It really is. And so what do you think the steps are that, to move forward here? And do you think this will perhaps derail the deal, or do you think it'll just make the value of the deal come in much lower?
Yeah, I mean, again, because the relative value to Verizon is not that large, there could be a case made that that Verizon just wants to use your accounts, wants to build its ad business, and is willing to look past this because this day and age, data breaches are actually not that uncommon. And you also have a sense that, so far as we know, no credit card information was stolen or really sensitive information like that. On the other hand, you could also make argue case that Verizon sees the opportunity here to renegotiate the deal. But they're angry. They feel that the information wasn't disclosed to them as quickly as they needed it to be, which could undermine trust, in Yahoo management. And they could try and recut the deal. Yahoo is not in a very strong position. They don't have much leverage. Their business is declining. So Verizon decides to be really aggressive. They could push for a lower deal price. I personally think the deal will get done.
Yeah, it seems that way. It seems all signs are pointing that direction. Well, we will keep turning to you at Wall Street Journal, Vipal Monga, reporter on this and all other things, many, many things. Thanks so much for sharing your knowledge with us today.
Thank you very much.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and we're going to keep this conversation going. In particular, we're going to talk about how you can protect yourself after. If you hear about a platform that has been hacked and it's a platform that you use, we're going to talk about that here in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We'll be turning things over to our good friend King John here in just a little bit. But, you know, we were talking about this interesting story that's been emerging about a data breach with Yahoo that happened a couple of years ago. But as we're moving into this space with this Verizon and Yahoo deal, this acquisition, at least of their core business anyway, these details have emerged a little clearer, and it's very interesting. So it's created a little bit of panic on Wall Street. Yesterday, we could see some investors reacting to that. Panic's probably a strong word, but we could certainly see that reflected in the market numbers. But New York Times has a really interesting piece that is very practical, and I like my stuff practical, my friends. And it is all about how to protect yourself after that Yahoo data breach. And it gives some really great and straightforward information that I think applies not just to this, but to all platforms. There are things we just need to do in our day-to-day lives, to protect ourselves. And the very first thing on their list, it says, the question is, how do I know if my personal information was stolen? Answer, assume it was, which I love that. Always assume it was. I think the same thing applies with like backing up your data, right? There's data that you have lost and there's data you have not lost yet. Always assume your computer is going to crash and back it up accordingly. Same deal here. Always assume that if there was a breach, go ahead and assume the worst there.
And I think Yahoo is the kind of company that you might need to make those kinds of assumptions because, like, I think I have a Yahoo account, but it was so long ago,
yeah.
I've moved on. But it's in there somewhere, so. And I don't know what information is on there. It's kind of like, you really have to think back.
Yeah, and there's a few other sites that you need to use your login, your Yahoo login credentials, like Flickr, things like that, that you'll use
right.
it. And then kind of forget and you'll stay automatically logged in. And, you know, every time you're connecting an account, using an account to log into another, you're essentially using an app interface and granting access to your login credentials and kind of creating another pathway for a data breach. So you want to protect yourself on that one. So go ahead and assume. Don't wait for them to notify you. If that applies to any platform, go ahead and assume that perhaps your information was accessed. The second one. The second question that the New York Times asks is, should I change my password? Yes, always. You should frequently change your password. I set calendar reminders just to remind myself to do it. But especially if you hear about, a bank or a social media platform or a large tech company, and it's a thing that you use, or you think you, even if you haven't used it in years, go ahead and change your password. It doesn't hurt. It doesn't cost anything to change your password. And it's always helpful to do so.
Do you keep all your passwords written down somewhere?
In my head.
In your head, yeah, me too. And that is not always the most reliable. I feel like I've got so many passwords now. If I was going to change, if I did like every 2 months, do a change just to feel protected, I'd be changing one of them every day. That would just be the calendar. Like, I've got too many things swirling around in my head now.
I mean, I have calendar reminders set. So it ends up being about every week or two once I'm cycling through all of them, because I don't want to do it all in one day. That'd drive me crazy. But I change passwords a lot. But I also use two-step verification on a lot of things, which is really good. So there's some sites you need my phone and my fingerprint and my password to get into it.
Or like your first pet's name. That's those kind of things. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that's really interesting. And when you sign up for something, those security questions that you'll set, those drive me crazy because they're never – I like the ones when you can set your own question. Like, ask me something that I know is not going to change, because the questions are so damn lame because they're always like, what's your favorite movie? That's going to change every week in my life. What's your favorite song? That's going to change every hour.
Right. Then it's just as hard as remembering a password, because you just have to remember how you answered it, that question a year ago, which is like, I don't know.
I don't know. What was I into then? What band was cool? I don't know. Right. What movie had I just seen? Things like that, those kind of drive me crazy. They need to have questions that are not going to change. But then some of that is easily find outable, like mother's maiden name. That's pretty easy. You can find that dirt on people pretty easily with lots of sites.
Yeah, I never thought about
like
that.
Like People Finder, you can go to that and find out people, and it'll say potential relatives, and it'll list like these people. And it's usually pretty accurate, which I recommend. You can opt out of all of those. And it's a process. You usually have to share a photo of your driver's license or some kind of proof of identity, but you can opt out of those, which is advisable because there's a lot of dirt on you in there. You know, there's public record information, but, you know, if you're not comfortable with that being out there, be done. On this New York Times list about how to protect yourself after that big Yahoo data breach, the third thing, it's also about passwords. It's like, how do I create stronger passwords? You know, I used to do a lot of work helping people with social media, and I cannot tell you how many times people use admin123, tribune123, and password123 as their password. My friends, please do not do that. I'm trying to make a complex password. There's a lot of password managers that you can use, like 1Password and LastPass. If that's your thing, if that's something that you would find valuable, do so. But, you know, try to mix that up. Don't make it spell anything. Don't just use letters. Don't use a word you say or a word you tweet or post or a family name. You know, things like that are figure outable. So go with those really complex passwords for sure.
We just had a caller. I forgot to get his name, but he said with those security questions, just write the same word for whatever the question is. And his example was mudroom. But like,
I've heard of someone doing that. Before,
it'll always be, and it doesn't actually give anybody information
about
it.
And it doesn't actually, you don't even answer the question. I've heard of someone doing that before. That's a good idea. Yeah. There's a lot of good stuff on this list from the New York Times about how to protect yourself after the Yahoo attack, that is really good. So I recommend go to thenewyorktimes.com and check this out, because there are really good pieces of advice in there that, you know, are things that we should do anyway. We shouldn't wait to hear about a data breach. We should regularly be updating these things for ourselves. And while we're at it, there's something that I do, and that is when I change my clocks for spring and fall, for daylight savings. And, you know, they say do your smoke alarm batteries then. In addition, I always check my security settings for my social media platforms, because sites like Facebook, they change their security questions often. And I'm not talking about login security. I'm talking about your privacy settings. And there's no right or wrong. It's a matter of what you're comfortable sharing, who you want to share with, and what you want to use Facebook for. But they frequently change and update features and parts of the site. And so I usually go through right then too and just go, here's a series of questions. Am I still comfortable with my answers? Boom, done. What do you do, Griffin?
What do I do? Bob, what do you do?
None of that. I'm bad.
I know. That's why I didn't want to answer. I'm kind of bad about it too.
What do you mean none of that? You don't check your Facebook security, or you don't update passwords or any of this stuff?
None of that.
I was just forced to change my password actually because somebody tried to log into my Facebook from Indonesia.
Oh, that was me.
Oh, that was okay. Well, cool. Then that's fine. You can go on my Facebook.
I was going to say something really clever.
I got my Amazon hacked, though, once.
You did?
Yeah, and I didn't have to. I just couldn't buy anything for about a week. And it was right before Christmas.
Oh.
And then everything worked out okay.
Ooh, that's unfortunate.
Because they couldn't. I had a live person, I think, who was helping me through it. And they said, well, tell us this information. And I said, I said, okay, that's blah, blah, blah. And they said, that's not what we have. So I was truly hacked.
It was it was a security question, or it was like address and stuff.
I think it was I don't remember.
Okay.
But whatever it was, the question they kept asking me, I said I don't, and I would give them the correct answer, and they said that's not what we have.
Okay, so step one is maybe remember your answers.
Oh no, they were right. I got hacked so bad that the person was able to change it.
Oh, that's happened to me before.
Yeah.
That happened with my banking information. They changed the phone number and the address. And so the bank was like, we did notify you. I'm like, no, you didn't. What's the phone number you use? And they gave me a phone number. I was like, that's
not. Yeah, that's what happened. So I think it was like a week later then I got a thing from Amazon saying, yeah, you were hacked. So I just put my trust in them. I don't need to. I mean, right? They'll get it right.
10,000 people just went to your Amazon account to try to bust in with that laissez-faire
kind
of attitude,
everyone.
Kessler.
That was a joke.
Sure. Was that the only kind? Is that the only time that you've had an account?
That is the only time. That's it.
That's good.
You'd think we'd learn something from Spaceballs.
Oh my God!
We remember the password for the air shield.
Yes.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Right. And yet, my friends, it is an increasingly technology-dependent world, and we must...
That was in the 80s.
Yes. But nonetheless, it is an increasingly technology-dependent world, and we must... We have to play in that space. That's the reality of the world now. And so we need to protect ourselves and be smart about the things we're doing online, because technology can do a lot of wonderful things for us and facilitate lots of great conversations and allow us to shop very easily and do
cat
lots
videos.
Of things. Really, cat videos, as Bob Kessler is saying, all of those things. But we also need to look out for ourselves online. So we're going to take a little break, chat with King John, and then turn the wheel over to him here in just a bit on 720 WGN.